This is a production of Cornell University.
Welcome to the podcast of Mann Library's Chats in the Stacks book talk series. In today's talk, originally presented at Mann Library on October 2nd, 2008, Dr. Karen Dunn-Haley explores the ideas for rural home design that Cornell faculty and home economists offered the public through the 1946 Farm and Home Special Demonstration Train. Dunn-Haley, the 2007 recipient of the College of Human Ecology's History of Home Economics Fellowship, compares their approaches to post-World War I and New Deal efforts to shape the rural home and provides a background history of university extension demonstration trains.
Fellowship in the History of Home Economics and Human Nutrition is dedicated to honoring our past through analysis informing the future mission of the College of Human Ecology. An award is typically given for a summer or sabbatical residency to utilize the resources available from the college and the Cornell University Library System in pursuit of scholarly research into the history of home economics and its impact on American society. And I would like to thank the current committee members for their work in advancing this mission. And just to give you the name of the committee right now, Jeff Sobel is currently the chair of the committee, and the other members are Elaine Hanks, Jan Jennings, Eileen Keating, Janet McHugh, Margaret Rossiter, Sharon Sassler, Linda Stewart, and Kay Obendorf is ex officio of that committee. And I'm very proud to have this committee still active and advancing this mission, because the history of this college is truly fascinating. I was so pleased when I learned that the last West Campus house in the West Campus system will be named after Flora Rose. I don't know if everyone knows that. That to have a building after Martha Vann and another building after Flora Rose is an incredible statement about the value of our college to the university, and I'm very proud of that. So this type of fellowship just continues to honor that, and I think it's great to coordinate this along with now the house system where we'll have Flora Rose House. This fellowship was started in 1992 and has attracted established historians and PhD candidates, and this year I'm very pleased to introduce to you the winner of the 2007 fellowship, Karen Dunn-Haley. Karen received her PhD from Stanford University in history, and is currently an independent scholar working out of California. She actually has a very fascinating history of looking at African history and American literature and generally 20th century American history. She's worked on historical perspectives on the presidential administrations, many of them, and she also has worked on a range of domestic and foreign policy issues. Today, she'll be speaking about a topic that's sort of never ends in some sense. So if you think about the financial markets, I don't know what the market's doing now. Every time I hate having that stock market ticker, and it's right over here on the wall in Warren Hall. So every time I come to the Mann Library, I have to look at my money going away. But when you think about the issues today of how important the housing market is, and that, in fact, the social goal that so many presidential administrations have had about getting people to own homes, as we think about the financial issues now, the drive for home ownership, you can see that the social mission of putting people in homes is very complex, and as we start intermixing that with our financial institutions, these are some of the fascinating issues that we have. So now we're gonna step back in time and look at other types of housing issues that have come along. And so again, I'm really pleased to have Karen here and looking forward to hearing your talk. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I want to thank the College of Home Economics, or the College of Human Ecology. That was a faux pas. The Mann Library staff and the Division of Rare and Manuscripts Collection staff for their support during my fellowship the summer of 2007. The opportunity to use the extensive resources at Cornell is something for which I'll be forever grateful. I owe thanks to many librarians here at the Mann, especially Mary Oakes, Elaine Angst, Sarah Keane, Eileen Keating, and Evelyn Ferretti. And I also owe thanks to Gene Enders, who today brought the model trains to the back. I would think that adds a lot, and I appreciate that. Well, on April 2nd, 1946, Cornell's Farm and Home Special started a journey covering 37 counties in rural New York, making 41 stops and drawing the attention of 68,000 visitors. The train, carrying exhibits and experts on the latest agricultural methods and on rural home improvement, was the first of its kind over 20 years. Today I'm going to provide you with some background on demonstration trains, the history of Cornell's demonstration trains, and more importantly, what message this particular post-World War II demonstration train tried to convey about rural housing design and how this message compared with earlier New Deal efforts to alter the rural home. In 1946, the Cornell Farm and Home Special capped a long history of demonstration trains. They were educational extension practices extended back to the turn of the century, especially designed to carry new agricultural and home economics methods to farm families. Trains were used by many state universities to take education to distant rural communities as early as the 1890s. This could be a surprise to some of you. Historian Marilyn Holt has compared demonstration trains to Booker T. Washington's Tuskegee wagons, which were termed movable schools of agriculture. Here you can see the Jessup wagon. These are National Archives photographs. And then the crowd gathering to listen to the lecture outside the wagon. These took practical information to African American farmers in the South. And like these wagons, and sponsored by railroads, which saw the potential of increasing profits if farm production increased, demonstration trains, supported by U.S. Department of Agriculture, carried labels much like Cornell's later version. They were called the Opportunity Special, the Diversified Special, the Alfalfa Special, and they drew tremendous crowds. For example, in 1924, the Santa Fe Railroad sponsored the Cow, Sow, and Hen Special. It drew well over 100,000 people. Actually, my source said 400,000, but I thought that could be a typo. I was being cautious. But it drew well over 100,000 people within Kansas, Texas, Oklahoma, and New Mexico as it made its rounds. Universities, which were held in low esteem by some farmers, sought to improve their image, as well as educate through demonstration trains. Railroad historian Richard Orsi has noted the cooperation between the University of California campuses at Berkeley and Davis and the Southern Pacific Railroad beginning in 1908 with what it called its University on Wheels. In small Central Valley and Sierra Foothill towns, the University of California train attracted as many as 1,500 people in each town, drawing such praise that the train was repeated for several years in a row, and then repeated several times before a final demonstration train visited by 50,000 people toured California in 1928. To illustrate that this was truly a national phenomenon, here are some photos for you of demonstration trains at the turn of the century from Ohio and Arizona and North Carolina. And they are faded because I pulled these off the web from historical societies. This one, if you look, it says University of Arizona there. And this would have been these were the early 19th century, around 1908, 1913. And here's another one. The one in the upper right is from Ohio. And that's there are more pictures if you're interested. You can Google demonstration trains. And you'll find some of these on the web. And this one here is from North Carolina. So Cornell used demonstration trains as early as 1909, when over 4 days, agricultural exhibits reached an audience of 25,000. train worked so well that in 1910, Cornell's Agricultural Extension launched the Fruit Special, which demonstrated better methods for spraying and packing fruit. But it was during and after World War I that Cornell's Home Economics Extension took the lead. And with the cooperation of the railroad and the support of the state, the Thrift Special toured parts of upstate New York in 1917, and it was followed by the Victory Special between 1918 and 1919. So you see here, this is the Thrift Special. Again, because of, it's hard to get the resolution, but up in the top it says Thrift Campaign, and this particular train, as I will explain, emphasized canned goods, and so that says canned goods, or canned foods there. Running over several railroad lines, including the New York Central, Lehigh Valley, Erie, and Ontario roads, the Victory Special attracted over 15,000 people and offered 124 meetings in total. Both of these trains emphasized food conservation, which was an imperative during World War I and its immediate aftermath, as Americans attempted to send surplus grain to Europe and to the starving people suffering due to the war. Cornell played a special role in the nation's conservation efforts. As many of you probably know, its head of the Home Economics College, Martha Van Rensselaer, was given leave to go to Washington to head the Food Administration's Division of Home Conservation, where she worked in Herbert Hoover's Food Administration. The emphasis on food conservation can be seen in these photos of canning exhibits. And here you see the train, this is the Victory Special, and the caption reads, "That interest in food conservation is limited neither to sex nor age as proven by the Victory Special, a typical daily crowd." So you had children, and there were also men, as well as women there learning about canning and food conservation. So although a housing shortage did face many veterans returning from World War I, home building and home repair was not the focus of the Victory Special as it was 27 years later. Instead, it was canning of food, as these photos further illustrate. And you can see how they managed to take the train and put demonstrations in there. Here's one where, again, there's a lectern where demonstrations could actually be conducted. And again, the canning exhibit within the train. According to publicity for the 1946 train, the last Cornell demonstration train of any major importance took place in April and November 1924, when the dairy train addressed the issue of bovine tuberculosis, which was a particular concern at that time. So successful in April was this train that it was repeated months later in November, and it drew over 13,000 people between the two trains. In 1946, the demonstration train replaced the annual Cornell Farm and Home Week, an agricultural and home extension event that for years had been extremely popular with upstate New Yorkers. This picture illustrates a panel of speakers that included Eleanor Roosevelt at Farm and Home Week in 1936. Under Flora Rose, Dean of the College of Home Economics through 1940, Farm and Home Week had attracted important personages to campus. Eleanor Roosevelt was a personal friend of Rose, and she made an annual pilgrimage to Farm and Home Week, where she usually spoke or offered a radio address. In 1940, Flora Rose's last year as dean, Eleanor Roosevelt spoke on hospitality in the White House, and she was joined on the dais by Mrs. Henry Morgenthau. And I sincerely hope that this person is not Mrs. Henry Morgenthau. I don't know who it is. There weren't names, or I don't believe a date given for this particular time on the dais, but this was typical in the 1930s. Eleanor Roosevelt would be participating in, among many speakers. And I picked this one because I did find it so amazing that this woman was sitting behind that fern the whole time. So, to a degree, Farm and Home Week programs for the 1930s reminds me of a county fair. There were practical demonstrations, there were contests, such as a stage contest for speaking, and absent with the war's end, in the fall of 1945, the College of Home Economics and Extension staff, service staff, began to plan its resumption. However, the large numbers of returning veterans that were entering Cornell at the time put a burden on accommodations and facilities on the campus, and it made welcoming the expected thousands of people who were interested in Farm and Home Week an impossibility on campus. So Extension Service Director L.R. Simons and his staff chose instead to partner with the New York Central and Erie Railroads to offer the Farm and Home Special. The train contained 8 cars, which featured home design, home management, freezing food, poultry equipment, labor-saving techniques for the farmer, dairy methods, vegetable crops, and hay and forage. Working with county, agricultural, and home extension agents, as well as the local 4-H, the College of Agriculture and Home Economics publicized the event through newspaper stories and radio broadcasts. And this is one of the example advertisements. WHCU Ithaca and WSYR Syracuse broadcast the opening ceremonies, during which time Dean Sarah Blanding of the College of Home Economics and Dean Myers of the College of Agriculture spoke. And this would have been towards the end of Dean Blanding's time. She left the same year to go to be president of Vassar, I believe. So this was one of the advertisements, and this is another one. And we have those samples at the back, too, that you can look at later. This listed where the train would be stopping, and it indicated all of the different types of cars and information that would be put forward. Press reports stressed the importance of food production, which had been very vital during the war and was expected to continue to be an important matter of national concern. The trains aimed to pass along labor-saving information so that production could continue to be high even as the numbers of farmers were anticipated to decrease. Farm families flocking to stations such as Jamestown, Elmira, or Oneida might have been most drawn to the car containing home-built freezers. And here I'm going to show you a slide of the people at the station. This is in New York Central. And you can see how many people were coming to go to these exhibits.
Yeah, where is that?
No, I don't know the town that happened to be in. The scrapbook, which is in the rare manuscripts collection, is an enormous thing. It's really impressive. And if you're really interested, you should go to the library and look at it. There are all sorts of press clippings. You definitely should do it. Yeah, I recommend it. So the car containing home-built freezers was a big pull. With wartime and food rationing still not completely behind people, most rationing ended around this time, but there was still some rationing that was extended after the war. The idea of having food always on hand through a fully stocked freezer had to be appealing to people who had been undergoing war rationing for many years. More than 2,700 people who viewed the train requested instructions on building a freezer. And here's another slide of people going to the train. Frequently mentioned in newspaper articles about the train was the home-built freezer, but also the new pesticide DDT was a big of interest to people at the time. Car 4 emphasized good barn design, and while we might consider it an odd juxtaposition, exhibits on good barn ventilation were in the same car as did the DDT exhibit. 2 models of a dairy barn floor plan showed how a better planned barn could save the farmer steps and how good ventilation could save on barn repairs. A full train car was devoted to home management with exhibits showing how to better store foods and dishes in kitchen cabinets, and how to create an efficient sewing cabinet, and how to cover the washing machine with a plywood cover on casters in order to add to your workspace. But it could also double as a child's playhouse when you pulled it away. The car that I'm going to focus on today, though, is the housing design car, which held suggestions for farm home remodeling. The suggestions were based on research then being conducted by the architect and home economics professor. She was an architect as well as a home economics professor, and her name was Grace Marin. Marin, traveling with the train along with 15 other experts, was present in the housing design car answering the public's questions. And accompanying her were assistants Dorothy Matlock, Dorothy Coors, and Jean Walker. And I'm going to first give you a little bit of background on Grace Marin. I found her a very interesting person. She was a Westerner, and since I'm from California, perhaps I found her even more compelling because of that. And she was born in Wells, Nevada in 1890 and came of age in San Francisco attending what is the highly regarded Lowell High School, and then she went on to attend UC Berkeley. She apprenticed under the famous female architect, Julia Morgan. And as World War I started, she moved to work as a draftsman for the Naval Architecture Department on Mare Island. And there, like many of the people, I've looked at many planners and housing experts from the 1920s on, and many of them had their roots in the U.S. Housing Corporation during World War I. And I didn't realize it until I looked more closely at her biography that really, in a way, she did too, because on Mare Island, which is located in the San Francisco Bay entry to the Sacramento River Delta, it was one of the locations where the U.S. Housing Corporation had a development. So it's quite possible that as a draftsman, she might have even been involved in that building. Those developments were innovative for their time, and when you see pictures of them, it's hard not to be struck by their similarity to present-day townhouses and condominiums. They had efficient, small, but modern open floor plans designed for workers' families. And I can't help but think that these open floor plans and the efficiency also affected the way she was to design later on for rural farmhouses in New York. So designed by people who later became well known as housing or planning experts, and among them were John Nolan, whose papers are also here at Cornell, and Frederick Law Olmsted Jr. This housing for war workers served as a model for housing developments from the 1920s to the present. After the war, Marin did advanced studies in fine arts and interior design at Columbia University. And in 1925, she came here and joined the New York College of Home Economics staff at Cornell. She became head of the Department of Household Art in 1929. And it's interesting, too, she had definite national connections to housing reformers. She participated in 1931 in the President's Conference on Home Building and Home Ownership, which was a very big national effort. And she contributed to more than one of the 11 volumes that emerged out of that all-encompassing national effort to reassess home building in the United States. She also was a member of the American Home Economics Association and published in its journal. So this is a person who was nationally connected. She was in charge of rural housing research at Cornell beginning in 1944. And in the post-war years, the documents in the College of Home Economics records bear witness as she struggled to maintain a key role and make her voice heard as the administration within the college, as some of you know, changed, and later, of course, the name of the college, as I didn't recognize completely at the beginning of my talk, the name of the college changed. But during this time, it's in the 1940s that you get a real change in the administration. And she retired in 1950, and it was before she retired even, this fellow, Glenn Byers, Professor Glenn Byers, was to take over the rural housing research project. And he continued it well into the 1950s. The housing design car on the Farm and Home Special brought the public's attention to one of the newest fields of research at Cornell. In 1944, the state legislature approved $10,000 for the study of rural housing. And that was a substantial grant at the time. And you can see in the records how there was a struggle over how it would be spent and who would get the power over it. And Grace Marin was in there struggling to keep her place. Commentators observed at the time that it had long been apparent that housing on many New York State farms was inadequate. But at that time, practically no investigation had been made on ways of improving the standard. The 1940 census underscored the problems with rural housing at the time. While close to 75% of New York's urban housing had been built since 1900, in the case of rural housing, close to 75% was built before 1900. And a third of that was built, a third was built before the Civil War. So that's a lot of very old housing. Comparing the percentages indicating access to electricity and running water only further pointed to the need for remodeling or rebuilding. 99% of New York's urban areas had those conveniences, electricity and running water, while only 68% of farm homes had electricity and 44% had running water. So that was a big gap to fill. In 1940, only 5% of New York's population lived on farms, with an additional 12% categorized as rural non-farm. So given that the rural non-farm population had an economic stake, a pretty direct economic stake in what was happening on farms with farmers, we can assume that 17% of the New York population would be concerned about rural housing. The number of farms in the state had declined from 1930 to 1940 by 4%, and as the war came to an end, there were concerns of a further decline, and there was a belief that improved living standards could keep people on the farm. So upon receiving the grants in 1944, a research staff at Cornell, which was headed by Grace Marin, included part-time assistants from Sherwood Holt and Thomas Baird, both professors and architects, and Marjorie Andrews, began to address the problem. By the end of 1946, a rural housing expert, Ruby Loper, also joined the project. Marin first gathered existing information on farm homes with special attention to the 1940 census, and she picked one county to survey, and that was Cortland County, where 1,480 families were sent surveys. She and her staff chose this county, and they asked them in the survey about the current state of their homes and any plans that they might have to remodel or rebuild. The questionnaire also provided them with the chance to ask for assistance, and they got a 5.4% return on that survey. That's not all that uncommon if you've sent out any surveys. They got 80 replies, and of these, 87% indicated that they plan to remodel or rebuild. And the things that they were hoping to change in their homes, they hoped kitchens, bathrooms, insulation, and central heating were the top things that they were looking for. And they were also, 20% of people wanted running water. Cortland County's results indicated that 7/8 of the present farm dwellings could be expected to undergo remodeling. One of the staff's concerns was that farm families would go about remodeling in a haphazard way that would waste their money. And to try to prevent this, they approached several families to offer plans and to use the plans as a demonstration of what families should consider. And it's important to understand, too, that those who invited the Cornell staff into their home, they generally seemed to have nicer homes than the rest. They weren't embarrassed to bring people in. So Grace Marin knew this, and she acknowledged in a summary in 1945 that only about a 12th of those who were checked by her staff really required major repairs, where the census would indicate that over a quarter in the county would need major repairs. So the initial research on Cortland County contributed to these exhibits that I'm about to show you that were on the home design car on the Farm and Home Special. The car featured before and after models of actual farmhouses chosen from the examples from Marin's research. This photo from the Cornell bulletin on the Farm and Home Special shows how the exhibit was set up. You had actual models of before and after. And you can also see the line of people there. Press accounts noted that the car on rural housing proved almost a bottleneck because visitors were so anxious to look at the plans and the models there. The models emphasized planning over actual building since materials were still scarce. The motto was plan now, build later. And you can see here that wartime posters, these are from the Smithsonian, illustrate the recognition that there were restrictions on building, although it's the next one that shows you that despite war restrictions, America's living standard is still the world's best thanks to U.S. industrial progress. You can see the symbolism of the home in this poster as well as in the one prior to that. Here, this poster reads, "This is America, a nation where with more homes, more motor cars, more telephones, more comforts than any nation on earth, where free workers and free enterprise are building a better world for all people. This is your America. You can see the connection between the house and between freedom in this poster. So there was a widespread expectation that there'd be a housing boom after the war. Housing expert Coleman Woodbury's papers here at Cornell include a 1944 lecture that he gave titled The Past 10 Years in Housing, in which he concluded, when the war ends, this country will have pent-up needs and demands for housing greater than we've ever known. Together, housing experts, those connected with housing, will face one of the greatest opportunities and greatest responsibilities that have ever confronted a similar economic and professional group in the United States. The College of Home Economics archives hold pictures of models of homes, as well as before and after pictures of homes redesigned by Grace Marin's division in 1946. And here's an actual picture of a house that she, her staff would have gone to and visited. Most likely, these were among the examples provided on the train. I don't have absolute proof, but I've scoured the scrapbook that's in the library, and this particular house that I'm about to show you, there are pictures that look very much like it in this scrapbook. This is a front view of an actual house that was part of the Home Research Bureau study, and this is the model of the proposed changes that we'll see in a second. This is, see the model, they made wooden tiny miniature models, and you can see here that they have added windows and a deck, and we'll talk about the meaning of that in a second. The windows actually, they provided sun and ventilation, but I think that one of the things that's important to understand is that in an old farmhouse, you would have kept the windows to a minimum because you didn't have central heating. As cheap central heating came into being, you could have more windows, assuming that it was cheap, central heating. Okay. So there's also added space as they pushed out the front. There's added space in the upper bedrooms. Here we could see the side view of the house. And you can see that the kitchen wing in the house was a separate structure, this part, that had just been kind of hitched on to the house. And no, it meant that, as we will see in the next slides, no privacy was allowed in the downstairs bedroom because there was no hallway. And we'll look for a second here. This is the model, the side view of the model. And you can see the additional windows that and doors to the outside provided. But now we're going to do, these are the before and after models that I believe were on the train. This up here is the before. And the after down here, and I'll try to guide you through this. Yes.
Would the kitchen have been added on at a later time, or do you think the original structure was all built at once?
I think this kitchen wing was probably added on. Yes, and that's why it seemed to be so just tacked onto it, and that's the way it was described in the literature.
Is that fairly typical, adding on?
Well, that's. I think so, because I came across another a different name. This was known as the Arnold House. In the archives, and I came across some descriptions of other houses which seem to have the same problem. Okay. So in this remodeled version, the back wing of the house, you could see that up here in the before version, there's a utility room that's just really, it's just like a shed. It's maybe where they stuck their vegetables and wood. And they changed that in the after version to a place where you put the freezer, because you want to have that freezer. And then the laundry room and a wash-up area for the men coming in. That's the way it's described in the literature of the men. But they also added a half bath here. You can see that here, it's just like, this is just sort of a haphazard space, and the stairs here were described as not very safe. And they've improved the stairs here and created a hallway and an entry into the kitchen, which has they recreated a kind of U-shaped space, which, as some of you who attend past talks know, this was a desired workspace for kitchens, the they created a doorway here. I don't know whether in the before, there must have been, there was a doorway, but it's not the hallway. Here, it goes into the dining room, not the living room. This was the living room here. And here is the bedroom on the first floor, which they've completely gotten rid of and moved to the top floor, in, as I'll show you in a second. In this model, they've added there's a fireplace here, which is odd because they had central heating. So the fireplace is clearly more of an entertainment motif as opposed to a practical thing. And they've also got the important thing that they've added here is the home office. So they took the previous living room, they've split it up into a dining room, and they have a hallway closet for guests, and then they've moved the living room over here. I have a bigger picture. This is the before, if you want to see it in a less confused manner here. So the back wing has been created. If we go to this is the before, and again, this is the after for the first floor. Now we're going to go to the second floor. And here you can see that the back wing has been altered. In the before here, there was just an open, there's no flooring here. The shed from the first floor would have gone up to the attic. And instead they've put in a floor and they've created a children's room here. So this is where the fourth bedroom will go that they lost from the first floor. And they've added closets, they've made the stairs safe, and they've created a playroom here. And they've pretty much left the bedrooms that are over here much the same, although they've been expanded because of that pushing out that we talked about earlier. And they've been given all these windows. And they've also got more closets. That was important, closet space. And there's still this rather tiny room here. The main bathroom for the house is here. So this was an example of how you could remodel, and it was well thought out by the research staff here. Survey results noted that many farm families wanted to reduce the space in their homes, not increase it. So this particular example reflects the needs of a larger family, but many farm families were decreasing in size. Approximately 70% of rural households in New York held four persons or less. So this would have been a little bit different because this is a larger family that's going to go in here. Given the desire for central heating, many families wanted to create smaller and more efficient homes. And so they came to Grace Marin and her staff and asked for ways to actually decrease the size of their houses. While I haven't established who lived in this house, it is, as I mentioned before, called the Arnold House in the archives. In another case, Grace Marin provided a pilot study on a family in Newark, New York, that involved a family with two children, 14 and 9 years old. In this case, the John Minor family wanted to remodel their old house until they could build anew. They planned to use the old house at that time for a tenant, and that was pretty common. The fact that the families were shrinking and sons and daughters were going off to the city often meant that the farmer had to turn to a tenant to take over some of the work. And in fact, on the farm and home special in the home design car, they had a model tenant house as well. And I think that we'll see one of that model, but I can't be sure it's that in a few minutes. They possessed, this particular family, the Minor family in New York, possessed electricity and hoped to get piped gas. And they wanted the remodel to improve the kitchen and utility room, as has occurred in this example. They also wanted to improve their bedrooms with storage and to install a heating system, as well as improve the stairs to the attic, again, like in this example. And the new house that they envisioned, however, they expected the old house to become the tenant's house. And the new house that they wanted to build once equipment and building supplies became available, and which money became available to them, they wanted it to resemble more closely the suburban houses that we're also familiar with. They wanted to have a recreation room in the basement and a two-car garage. So here is an example of one of the models that I believe was on the train. And you can see here that there's a garage in this model. So by 1951, in Grace Marin's last contribution to Cornell's bulletin series, she noted specific problems are involved in building a farmhouse, mainly because a dwelling is an important unit in the entire farm operation. However, it must be kept in mind that the basic principles of adequate housing are fundamental, whether the housing be for rural or non-farm families or for urban families. And, oh, again, this is the tenant house, I think, with the garage, without people hanging over it. And then you can see here how this suburban house comes to be a model for a rural house. I mean, this is her 1951 farmhouse planning bulletin, and the house really could be, it doesn't have to be in a farm area, it could be anywhere. The fact that rural housing could be seen in terms of basic principles that might apply to urban homes as well reveals both the progress made since the 1930s and the rising expectations that contrasted with the more limited expectations of a prior decade. And now I'm going to talk for a bit about how this compares with the 1930s. In a USDA publication, the Extension Service Review in 1936, one article asked, "What do farmers want?" While modern homes were cited as a universal desire, the article stressed better roads, shorter hours, better schools, better community life, and water and electricity, as well as better soil. Speaking to the need that Grace Marin and her staff attempted to address 10 years later, the article noted that there was a lack of knowledge as to what a modern home is. But significantly, one of the serious considerations that they were addressing was the fact that the scattered, isolated nature of farm life was a problem for people. People just felt too isolated. Community was the important thing. So housing planners before the war, housing planners during the New Deal and within the Resettlement Administration, looked to redesign farm housing with a broader brush than that proposed by the Cornell State staff in 1946. They experimented with creating communities out of whole cloth. And one example, I have failed to go here. Here's another example. It's a 1957 brochure, and you really see that suburban ideal implanted as a farm, that it should be labeled a farmhouse. It just seems incongruous. But I'm taking you actually back to the 1930s here. In the archives here, the John Nolan papers, John Nolan was one of the designers for a Resettlement Administration project called Penderley. And this is Penderley's design. And you can see, when I say whole brush, that they tried to create a community. That their main, when they were looking at rural housing, it was, what are we going to do about the community? And they were creating really a development where the homes, while they would have 20 acres that they were supposed to be self-sustaining upon, they would also be close enough, and we'll see that in the next, actually, in this slide. The houses are close enough here that they can still be neighbors. They can cooperate. The housewives can talk to each other. And that was one of the concerns that New Deal planners addressed. And you can also see here that, I want to back up it for a second and explain that Penderley was conceived during World War I by a guy named Hugh McCrae. And he worked with businessmen, philanthropists, and people like John Nolan for decades in order to try to achieve this vision of this self-sustaining rural community. And it's only during the Depression and the New Deal that he was able to, through the Resettlement Administration, get it off the ground. These pictures show that the houses that were constructed in this New Deal project are very simple. They're very simple compared to the models that we see Grace Marin dealing with in the 1940s. And in fact, the attention that was given, as I'm trying to contrast, was not to the interior of the house. Here's examples of the interior drawn from the Penderley Museum, which this is on the web. You can see that the interior of the house is very simple. The houses were actually heated by a fireplace in this case because there was plenty of wood in situated. But they didn't give so much attention to the interior of the house as to the community itself. So farm housing during the New Deal looked to encourage this larger community cooperation and participation, while the housing prescriptions that we see 10 years later through Grace Marin and Glenn Beyer focus more closely on the family and on individual needs. When Ruby Loper, Grace Marin's successor, asked the question, "And now what do you want?" in her 1948 compendium of farmhouse plans, the answers reflected the needs as expressed in the Cortland County Survey and subsequent Cornell research. Among the host of desires that farm families wanted was a kitchen that would allow the homemaker to view the child's play area. The entrance drive, and it would allow her also to view the entrance driveway. And you can recall the large windows in the model, the remodeled version that Grace Marin designed. Marin. I can't decide whether to say Grace Marin or Grace Marin. When you're looking at history, you don't know what pronunciation is. So you can see the windows in what she designed really. That was a definite desire, to be able to look out and see your farm buildings, to be able to look out and see your children, as well as see any guests that might be arriving. They also wanted a utility room that would function as a laundry room, furnace room, or cleanup area for the men, as we saw. They wanted more closets and storage, many of the elements that were featured in the before and after model that we just went through. And her 1951 bulletin on farmhouse planning notes the need not just for one office location, but possibly more. She speaks of centers for keeping household and farm accounts, a homemaker center, as well as an undisturbed area, preferably an office, for keeping farm accounts and receiving business callers. The area, she writes, should be more easily accessible to the outdoors and have a view of the principal farm buildings. The changes I've mentioned that New Yorkers desired in their farmhouses reflected national trends. Historian David Dambaum has discussed how rural life began to be less distinctive and more like suburban and urban life in the post-war years. Beyond New York, farmers expected the comforts of suburban or urban living that went beyond the basics, not just electricity, central heating, and bathrooms, but they expected mud rooms and recreation or family rooms and better kitchen workspaces. By the 1950s, the efforts of farm families, with the assistance of housing experts such as Grace Marin, Glenn Beyer, and Ruby Loper, to update the rural home, were well on their way to success. The message carried by the Farm and Home Special had been received and acted upon. The fact that farmhouses were becoming more similar to urban and suburban living was reflected in the popular culture. These are more pictures of, this is my final picture. As late as September of 1959, the sixth season of the television show Lassie premiered, and the first episode was titled The New Refrigerator. In this episode, Ruth Martin, who was played by June Lockhart, as many of you may remember, she got a new electric refrigerator to replace her icebox. Well, she was thrilled and ecstatic. Lassie didn't like the change. This is the plot of the old icebox was quiet, and everyone had liked, I think it was Mr. Cuffy or Mr. Guppy, who was the iceman delivering the ice. And the episode ended with Lassie accepting the new refrigerator because Timmy got hurt and they were able to quickly get ice out of the refrigerator. It's just serendipitous that I knew about this episode because when I was in grad school, my son had to stay home. He was sick, and I was doing something that related to electricity coming into the home in the 1930s, and there was this episode on TV that I was watching because my son was sick, and I couldn't believe it. Here was 1959, and they were still talking about this. It seems unbelievable that one of the nation's popular television programs ran an entire episode, and I swear to you, I've seen it. It was an entire episode about a new refrigerator, and this was in 1959. So the popular culture recognized the shrinking gap between rural and suburban and urban life, and at the same time, you can see in this show that they nostalgically looked to a past where there actually was a difference, and they kind of regretted that this sameness was taking place. So the farm and home special takes us to that point in time where rural homes start to look more like suburban homes. But what kind of message does this train provide for us today? And I'm going to suggest that it may have a different kind of meaning. Because we can see in this story how the university reached out with practical advice to the public at a time of economic transition and changing infrastructure. Does that sound familiar? It's also worth noting that these extension efforts were free to the public, and pains were taken to make sure they did not include any references to commercial products. And that's clear in the scrapbook. Unlike today's television counterpart, the extreme home makeovers that were recommended on the Farm and Home Special were designed to be low cost and home built, as in the home freezer that we discussed. As Americans look to alter the way they use their homes today to make them more energy efficient and to possibly take them off the grid, after so much effort was put into putting them on, in order to make the homes more self-sufficient through the use of solar, fuel cells, and wind power, it's worth examining the concerted effort that was made by planners, government officials, business, and university experts during the 20th century to modernize all American homes, lastly, rural homes. And we can ask, and I throw this out to you, perhaps we can discuss this after. What is today's counterpart to the Farm and Home Special? Think about it. That's my talk today.
Mention made of the Sears Roebuck house and how that fit in.
That's where I'm from. It's on my computer. The Sears Roebuck house. The prefabricated houses.
There were several in Ithaca.
Yes. I didn't come across in Grace Marin's research any discussion of what to do about or how you would modernize the prefabricated houses. I have an interest in those, and there's recently been an exhibit at the Museum of Modern Art, as I understand it, in New York City, and I went online to look at their exhibit, and they have this wonderful movie, I recommend it to all of you, a Buster Keaton movie, which satirizes putting together one of those houses. It's online, you can download it, and it's just a hoot.
What's the style of those houses? Is that like, I've heard about the four square with the four bedrooms and the four, you know, is that
the style of the
Sears? Yeah.
I believe those prefabricated houses came in all sorts of different styles.
Yeah,
there were catalogs, and there were all sorts of different,
different
styles. And it may be that those were, well, remember that those were from the 1920s, 19-teens. They were post-1900. Our real concern here was to try to remodel houses that came before 1900. So that's something to keep in mind, and that may be why I didn't see any reference to the prefabricated houses. One thing that there was in the various Cornell bulletins about farmhouse remodeling and reconstruction or rebuilding, there were some modular houses that were recommended that were very modern looking, and the idea was that you could build one part at a time. You could add on bedrooms as you wanted to. You could start cheap and build on. So you can go back into those bulletins and see some examples like that. Any other questions?
How does Tenderly relate to the green belt houses that came to the
resettlement? Well, it was a rule. It does relate. It was built by the resettlement administration and later taken over by the Farm Security Administration, which, by the way, the FSA did give grants to some of these upstate New Yorkers who Grace Marin was working with. There was some federal funding behind some of this remodeling. I found references to that. But as far as the exact relationship, there's some of the same planners that worked on the suburban greenbelt towns also worked on some of the more rural resettlement administration. I picked Tenderly because I just found it such a fascinating story in the John Nolan papers. Paul Konkin, who wrote a book in 1959 which has the whole story of Penderly in it, and it was published by the Cornell Press, he wasn't relying on the papers that are here. He was relying on Senate documents and on newspaper accounts, but the John Nolan papers, which are now here, really add a whole dimension to the story of Penderly, because you can see the personal correspondence that went back and forth between Hugh McCrae and various people interested in housing and philanthropists interested in housing at the time, and how he worked for decades trying to get this off the ground. He really believed in it, and it wasn't just that the houses be there for returning veterans or for people who needed them, but he also believed in the idea of self-sustenance, that you would have diversified agriculture taking place on these 20 acres. You wouldn't just have a monoculture, and that was a very important part of his vision, was that he wanted diversified agriculture to take place and be self-sustaining for these farmers on 20 acres. It was a bit unrealistic, as it turned out. Yes?
As a 4-H kid in the 40s, coming to Cornell in the 50s, I would think a lot of the changes in the houses were driven by the marketplace. TV coming into the living room, the freezer plan that my mom and dad had, which we supplemented out of the 4-H garden by blanching the beans or whatever and putting them in the pot, and then going into the commercial freezer, which probably came free because you bought, you know, the product from the company. So there's a lot of commercial enterprise that drove, perhaps, the changes in housing in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. So.
I think, and Ronald Klein, a historian here at Cornell, has written about consumption, and I don't know if he's in the audience here, but he's written about how that kind of technology and that kind of consumption altered the home in that period, and it's certainly true. You can see in my model how the making space for the freezer was an imperative. The other thing that I think is interesting is that the inclusion of a home office space, because farming became not a diversified thing. In most cases, it was monoculture again, and a really big business, and you had to keep track of your records in a way in the post-war period, during the World War II period. Your records keeping was more important even than it had been before. It became more of a business enterprise. Yes?
My understanding of this period is that the availability of building supplies, materials, influenced a lot of construction. Was that referred to much in this plan of work?
Well, that's the plan now, build later thing. They didn't want people to rush into building because of the lack of supplies. They were concerned that people would waste money and do things the wrong way. When I say they, I mean the experts here at Cornell. And so they wanted people to get advice and think about it and build out slowly. Maybe the plans, the before and after pictures I showed you, the after could be done in stages. It wasn't necessarily going to be done all at once.
This has been a production of Cornell University, on the web at cornell.edu.